KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the hour, John Nichols of The Nation will talk about what Super Tuesday showed about weaknesses of both Biden and Trump, as well as some signs of strength. Also, it's time to add a real right to vote to the Constitution. That's what Rick Hassan says. He's a professor of law and political science at UCLA and author of the new book, A Real Right to Vote. And he argues there are good reasons why Republicans could support a voting rights amendment. But first, today's political update with Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's editor-at-large of the American Prospect. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
The presidential election began for real this week when the Super Tuesday primaries established that Trump would indeed be the Republican candidate challenging Joe Biden. But there's more. The Supreme Court has once again made itself a huge force in presidential politics. A few weeks ago on this broadcast, you predicted that the court facing two huge cases about Trump would split the difference, giving him one win, the Democrats one win. They would rule, you predicted, that Trump couldn't be excluded from the ballot, and they would also rule that he did not have immunity from criminal prosecution, so he'd have to stand trial for charges around the January 6th insurrection. So that meant that the trial might lead to a conviction before Election Day. So one Supreme Court ruling for Trump, one against him. That's what we thought they would do. It's not exactly what happened. Let's start with the court's ruling on the 14th Amendment, Section 3, which bars anyone from holding office who engaged in insurrection or gave aid and comfort to people who did. We were not surprised that the court had a majority in favor of keeping Trump on the ballot, but there were some surprises in the ruling, some big surprises.
Yeah, that was one hell of a surprise. All nine justices essentially ruled that a single state cannot exclude a presidential candidate from the ballot. I mean, there are reasons for that, but mainly just the chaotic, crazy quilt that could result from that. However, the court split 5-4 on going beyond what was actually before it, which was the, could Colorado exclude Trump from the ballot? The five of the six Republican justices went beyond that to rule that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment didn't really carry any weight because it wasn't, the term is self-executing. That means, well, Congress has to do more. Congress has to pass a law presumably saying, in essence, that the 14th Amendment, Section 3, is something we take seriously. Now, none of the other provisions in any of the three Reconstruction-era constitutional amendments, which Eric Foner has described really as the constitutional refounding, have been viewed as not self-executing. All of them are pretty clear. When the Constitution says we abolish slavery, that meant they abolished slavery. Similarly, pretty much everyone before the rise of Trump thought that when the 14th Amendment Section 3 said essentially that insurrectionists, must be barred from holding federal office, that essentially meant what it said. But. Five of the six Republicans said, well, Congress has to pass a law because we don't think this is self-executing. Of course, there's a lot of, constitutional amendments that are presumably, self-executing, and maybe it calls those into question. For instance, the 22nd Amendment limits the president, to serving no more than two terms. This was passed in the early 1950s as sort of an after-the-fact Republican repudiation of Franklin Roosevelt, who served, was elected four times. But, Congress has never gotten around to passing a law saying, well, not only does this constitutional amendment ban the president from serving more than two terms, but we actually mean that. You know, now I think the court has really raised a question as to whether any language is self-executing in the Constitution. They're sort of declaring the Constitution unconstitutional, all in the service of Donald Trump.
And then there's the second case, Trump's appeal of the federal indictment charging him with crimes around the January 6th insurrection. He claimed immunity, arguing that nothing a president does in his official capacity in office could be a crime. Now, that's obviously absurd. What if he ordered SEAL Team 6 to kill his rivals? We know that in America, no one is above the law. That seemed perfectly clear. The appeals court, which included Republicans, was unanimous in saying that's perfectly clear. That's not exactly what the Supreme Court said.
Well, the court chose an artful way of helping Donald Trump, which is to say they didn't dispatch this with dispatch, as Jack Smith, the federal prosecutor, had asked them to do, because it was such a slam dunk case. It was actually a judge who came up with the notion of the SEAL Team 6 assassination, you know, and it just patently ridiculous. Now, but the court said they'll get to it in, actually, they just scheduled oral hearings for April 25th, rather than ruling on this right now, meaning almost certainly that they will deliver a decision on the last day the court is in session, which is usually the very end of June. And this has the effect of delaying the most serious trial that Trump faces, essentially for fomenting the January 6th, whatever it was, uprising, insurrection, at least until, you know, maybe the fall, making it more likely that no verdict will come down until after the election. Now, I expect the court will, in fact, say that, no, the president cannot cite immunity for any law breaking like this. But by delaying it, they give a huge advantage to Trump, because the polling shows that any number of people who would vote for Trump would not if he were convicted. And this just raises greatly the possibility that a conviction would not come before Election Day.
Well, now it's time for news of the class struggle in America, a regular feature of this broadcast. Two huge corporations have opened the door to unionization in the last week, Microsoft and Starbucks. What the heck is going on? Let's start with Microsoft. We've talked here many times about militant organizing campaigns at many corporations, but not Microsoft. What's going on there?
Well, there was a campaign when Microsoft was attempting to buy Activision, which they finally did, of the communication workers, which is really a very together union, was waging among the 700 Activision game creator workers. And the case had raised the anxiety and hackles of antitrust advocates, who didn't see any reason why this case should go through. Microsoft realized it needed, you know, some support from some progressives out there, and agreed to go neutral, not to oppose the campaign that CWA was waging to unionize Activision. But then, suddenly, Microsoft said, well, and we wouldn't be opposed to any of our employees unionizing, which was kind of like a bolt from the blue. This is not what major American corporations do. I mean, this is like hitting them in the knee and there's no reaction instead of the knee jerk. But, you know, there are some reasons, I think, for this. Microsoft has a highly skilled, very mathematically adept workforce, mainly of young people. And they're probably looking at, what those young people value. And their future employees, who are graduate student teaching assistants and research assistants, are voting at a 90% rate to unionize. the graduate students at both MIT and Caltech have overwhelmingly voted to unionize, and Microsoft, you know, wants them to come to Microsoft instead of, you know, Google or Facebook. So I think that's where Microsoft is headed.
And then let's talk about Starbucks. Very much the opposite story. Over the last couple of years, the corporation has set the standard for firing every pro-union employee they could. There's been an intense grassroots organizing campaign among baristas, which you have often talked about here. But Starbucks sort of set the standard for anti-union militants. What happened at Starbucks?
Well, the baristas won. The baristas had organized 400 of the Starbucks. Starbucks was really beginning to take a beating in public opinion. In theory, that it did, some maybe disproportionate share of Starbucks, consumers are urban and hence liberal. So that was, you know, it was taking a toll. Plus which, a major factor, the founder of the company, Howard Schultz, who clearly viewed unionization as a repudiation of everything he had worked to create, which, you know, in many ways it's not, but but that's what he thought. Fortunately for the world at large, he stepped down, and the new CEO seemed to be not so paranoid about the consequences of unionization. And somewhat stunning everybody, a mediation that was going on over a relatively small side issue suddenly expanded to the extent that the company agreed, A, not to oppose the unionization of future outlets, B, to sign a national contract, you know, setting wage and benefit standards with employees at any outlet that votes to go union, and C, when there are individual particular issues at a Starbucks to negotiate a side agreement there. This is historic and stunning because nobody has organized large number of workers who can be replaced illegally, but it's, as you said, common practice. Nobody has really done this almost since the 1950s. And it opens a door to, I'm not quite sure what. I mean, the other point that Starbucks and Microsoft workers have in common, they're disproportionately young. And among the young, the favorability rating of unions is certainly in excess of 70%. And some polling has shown it almost at 90%.
And now it's time for your Minnesota moment. That's news from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sean Hannity. Harold, you have just returned from the Twin Cities, the latest front of the class struggle in America. Why did you go and what did you find there?
I went because a whole bunch of rather disparate unions that historically have no particular connection to one another had agreed to sort of simultaneously do strikes or threaten strikes, or either because the contracts are expiring or they had unfair labor practices. And so there were joint actions in Minneapolis, St. Paul over the last few days, earlier this week, from a janitor's union and a home care, a nursing home workers union and the teachers union and the laborers, unions that don't normally have this kind of connection, plus some community groups of immigrants working in construction, who are not in a union, immigrants working in some janitorial positions that are not in a union, and some community support groups and some renters' rights groups. So it really was it's not a general strike, which Minneapolis actually had in 1934, but it was a level of coordination to raise particular broader issues about good schools and safer working conditions and more affordable housing, and more affordable housing whose construction workers aren't subjected to wage theft, all sort of coming together in a real mishmash. And in many ways, they had a lot of support. There were events at the state capitol. with the Senate Majority Leader speaking alongside them, events at the City Hall in Minneapolis with the president, the vice president of the City Council, who was actually a former SEIU worker, chairing this hearing. So there's a lot of support there, and they have, I think, come up with a particularly effective way to join forces and, campaign for, and in many ways get what they're campaigning for.
And when will we be able to read your report at prospect.org?
I think I'll actually have it up next Monday. I have to finish some interviews by phone, but it was really impressive. And there was a great joint action between renters' rights and immigrant workers who are subject to wage theft by, some company that own a lot of the buildings where the renters' rights are, and sort of the coming together of these two groups. I was at kind of a dress rehearsal of a theatrical production they're staging, which was quite enjoyable and remarkable.
And finally, we're speaking on Thursday at midday. Tonight, President Biden delivers the State of the Union address, his last big chance to prove to anxious Democrats, skeptical independents, and all America that he remains mentally and physically up to the job. Maureen Dowd in the New York Times on Sunday had a wonderful piece about the speech he should give. She thought he should open the State of the Union speech by declaring, quote, "My report is this. The state of my mental competency is strong, and the union's okay, too," close quote. What do you think he should say?
I think that's exactly right. Although the second part of that, the union's okay, too, he has to sort of go forward with what he's going to propose to hold down prices, to reduce drug prices, to create legislation that will create more affordable housing. He really has to address that, and also affordable childcare, the sort of issues that really would distinguish his second term from a Trump second term. So he needs to do that. But yes, he's also, just the sheer delivery of the speech is the kind of thing that people will notice. He will get one or two more major opportunities to address the mass audience, one, his acceptance speech, presumably at the Democratic National Convention, and two, if it happens, a debate with Donald Trump in the fall. But yes, this is really a very important night for Biden's prospects, and by extension, therefore, for America's prospects.
One last thing, the Jared update. A headline in the Israeli left-wing newspaper Haaretz on Wednesday reported that American Jewish leaders were, quote, shocked and profoundly troubled by the fact that the Anti-Defamation League honored Jared Kushner. The CEO of the ADL said, quote, "We cannot allow the partisanship and the polarization that has poisoned so much of our society. We can't allow it to do the same to us. I really don't care how you vote, but the Abraham Accords are a groundbreaking achievement," close quote. I wonder if you have any comment.
Yeah, well, I mean, as perhaps the chief advisor to Donald Trump in general, it's hard to imagine anyone on the American political scene who has been so instrumental to the most divisive and defamatory president we have ever had, possible exception of Andrew Johnson. I would add there was one thing, I was looking at what Kushner actually said that I found so astonishingly repulsive to American Jews. He kept saying, look, you really need to embrace Christian evangelicals because they are pro-Israel too. But Christian evangelicals are also pose a mortal threat to sort of everything here domestically that Jews, count upon, from freedom of speech to their own safety, to the right to a woman's right to an abortion. I mean, this was malignant nonsense, as was the ADL's award to Jared Kushner itself.
Harold Meyerson, read him at prospect.org. Harold, thanks for talking with us today.
Always good to be here, John.
Same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. For analysis of Super Tuesday's primary election results, we turn, of course, to John Nichols. He's the nation's national affairs correspondent and author of many books, most recently, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism, co-authored by Bernie Sanders. We reached him today in Madison, where he's traveling with the Vice President, Kamala Harris. John, welcome back.
It's good to be with you, John.
Well, we're speaking on Wednesday morning. Let's start with Biden. In the last weeks, a movement has arisen to use primary ballots as a way to demand an end to American support for the death and destruction in Gaza. There's more than two dozen states that permit voters to cast uncommitted ballots or undeclared vote ballots or no preference ballots. And in all of those states, if 15% of the voters choose one of those options, they get to send a delegation with no obligation to back Biden, and they could raise the issue of Gaza at the convention. Michigan pointed the way, but didn't quite get to 15%. In Michigan, the uncommitted vote was 13%. Did any of the Super Tuesday states reach the 15% threshold for sending uncommitted delegates to the convention?
Yes, they did. And before I will, before I go to that part of the answer, let me say that it is statewide and at the congressional district level. So yes. Michigan produced several delegates for uncommitted out of the two congressional districts where uncommitted got over 15%. That's the district around Detroit, Dearborn, and the district around Ann Arbor, University of Michigan. So they got a couple there. But you're right, statewide, they got around 13%. Minnesota, good Midwestern state that you know a little about, John.
Thank you very much.
They, of course, always, you know, they're modest Minnesota Knights. And so Minnesota looks like, when all is said and done, to have gotten in the range of 18 to 19%, substantially more than Michigan. And they will get four to five delegates, at least, out of Minnesota. You also have some very strong showings in North Carolina, probably about 12 to 13%. We don't know down to the congressional district level there, but I suspect there might be a delegate there. And then we're going to keep an eye on a couple other places. But Minnesota really stood out as the place that produced so far, by far, the highest vote for uncommitted, and suggested that this campaign that's sort of slowly developing, literally people just learning about it, has the potential to move beyond just Michigan. Of course, Michigan got all the attention because it has a large Arab American, Muslim American population. But what we're seeing is that this uncommitted campaign, in addition to doing well in places with a large Arab American, Muslim American population, also tends to do well in places with a large university and student population. And that's some of what we saw up in Minnesota.
The Democratic National Convention doesn't begin till August 19th. I really hope Israel will have stopped killing people in Gaza by that time, but it seems like the main impact of the uncommitted delegates will be starting now for the rest of the campaign. In fact, it seems like the Biden administration is already responding after Michigan to this campaign. Remind us what's happened just in the last couple of days with the Biden and Israel.
Well, look, Joe Biden is a career politician, 36 years in the Senate, 8 years as vice president, 4 years now as president. There's nothing that he doesn't know better than politics, right? And the people around him as well, many of them, you know, long-term political observers, they know their way around Democratic primaries. They know the way around national elections in which they have to rally the Democratic base. And so they're very conscious of what happened in Michigan. And they're going to be very conscious of what happened in Minnesota and some of these other states. What you saw right after the Michigan result was notable because within days, Joe Biden was talking about dropping food into Gaza. Now, it's a small drop, insufficient. They still have to open that border. But it was at least some show of an understanding of the humanitarian crisis that is playing out there. Additionally, Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris have ramped up their discussions of ceasefire. In fact, Harris and Selma on Sunday gave a very pointed address in which she talked a lot about ceasefire. Now, again, when they talk about ceasefire, it's somewhat muted because they don't talk about a permanent ceasefire, right? They're talking about maybe a 6-week ceasefire. That's problematic, but it is still clear evidence that, in my view, the White House is hearing or noticing what's going on.
So let's move to the Republican side, where, of course, Trump was challenged by Nikki Haley, who since then has suspended her campaign. But we need to look at the weakness that Trump showed in several states among Republican voters, just to run down some of the results and then ask for your comment. In Minnesota, Trump got 69% of the Republican vote. In North Carolina, 70% of Republican men, 64% of Republican women. In Virginia, Trump got only 59% of Republican women. And in North Carolina, 78% of the Nikki Haley voters refused to say they would support Trump. In Virginia, 68%. How significant a problem is this for Trump?
It's a significant problem. Look, I think you're underestimating the Nikki Haley juggernaut. In the last several days, she actually won two primaries. She won the District of Columbia, not a surprise because DC tends to be a much more progressive or liberal or moderate or at least sane place than some of the other spots that have had caucuses and primaries. She also won Vermont just by a couple points, but she won the state of Vermont. That's a very notable reality because here you have a sitting president or an immediate former president of the United States, a guy who is essentially the clear front runner and pretty obviously the choice of the party, losing primaries. And in other states, substantial votes for an alternative candidate, as you've noted. Now it looks like Haley is going to suspend her campaign. Doesn't look like she's going to see this thing through. But we've had enough primaries, enough caucuses, and enough exit polls that we have pretty solid evidence that those Haley votes are not so much Haley votes. Maybe there are a few people who actually like her, but primarily anti-Trump votes. And that in some cases, they are very anti-Trump to the point that they will not vote for him. What this means for Biden and for the Democrats is that they need to tailor an appeal to these folks. Now, they're not going to get very far if they try to change their stance on issues, if they try to go right wing or, you know, play to the center. That's always an absurd game that Democrats fall into, and it's invariably a mistake. The smart move is to play to democracy, to simply say, look, you may disagree with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris on some issues, but you have to recognize that Donald Trump is a clear and present threat to American democracy. He says as much. I'll be a dictator on day one. And so with that in mind, the primaries and caucuses have given the Democrats some sort of model that they can use going into a November election, where, again, the assumption is that Biden will be the nominee. Not the certainty. We'll see how things progress. But if it is a Biden-Trump race, these democracy issues will become very, very important for the Democrats as they tweak out their message nationally.
In the Senate races, two interesting ones nationally. Of course, California is going to elect a Democrat to replace Dianne Feinstein. It's always been pretty clear that Adam Schiff, hero of the first Trump impeachment in the January 6th hearings, was always the clear leader. But there were two people to his left, Katie Porter and Barbara Lee, both in the race. Tens of millions of dollars was spent by Democrats competing with each other. California takes a very long time to count its millions of mail ballots, but as of today, Wednesday morning, the total of Katie Porter and Barbara Lee votes is less than Adam Schiff. California, let's just remember, has that unfortunate system. I live in California, where the top two vote getters face each other in November, no matter what. Progressives were hoping to make that a contest between two Democrats. That's not going to happen. Steve Garvey, the Republican candidate, got the second most votes. And let's remember, Adam Schiff, he's considered a centrist, but I think he's moved to the left a little bit since all of the impeachment activity. Right now, he's calling for getting rid of the Electoral College, eliminating the filibuster, expanding the Supreme Court. The one good thing for Democrats about Steve Garvey coming in second and going on to face Adam Schiff in November is Democrats will stop spending tens of millions of dollars fighting each other, and that's money that can go into the Senate campaigns for the really embattled Republicans running in Ohio, Montana, Arizona. What's your perspective on what happened in California in the Senate race?
Adam Schiff had the money. He had some of the key endorsements from the folks who are very, very influential in the California Democratic Party. And he got the race he wanted. Remember, Adam Schiff went into this primary process and spent quite a bit of his money attacking Steve Garvey. Obviously, those attacks on Steve Garvey were fun to do, right? As a Democrat, you say Steve Garvey's this bad player. But they also emphasized that Garvey was a Republican. And so effectively, Adam Schiff gave Garvey a lot of publicity. And I think that helped Garvey to come through with actually a pretty strong showing in the primary. So now you're going to end up with a Schiff-Garvey race. The likelihood is, of course, that Schiff wins in the two-thirds Democratic state of California. Schiff didn't do his party any favors because when you're going to have a Democrat-Republican race in California, that helps to mobilize Republicans down ballot in those congressional races. Yeah. So the much better situation, I think, for Democrats would have been to have Schiff versus Katie Porter or Schiff versus Barbara Lee. But that hasn't happened. So now you're in this circumstance where you're going to have a clear partisan split. My sense is that you're right. The Democrats aren't going to have to put any money into California unless something really goes awry. And even if there was a need for money, Adam Schiff is a master fundraiser, so he's going to have enough. There you have it. The one positive for Democrats is this. Because it will be a somewhat competitive Senate race, that may up turnout in California. And if we are talking about the popular vote for president, California is the great popular vote producer. And so if there are more voters coming out in California, that increases the likelihood that Joe Biden may get, again, what he had last time, which is a very large popular vote victory. That helps, you know, at a time when you have a Republican opponent who's always trying to delegitimize the winner of the election. So this thing cuts a lot of different ways. I'm personally not a fan of that sort of game of trying to choose your opponent by spending money attacking a Republican in the primary so that Republicans may note that person. And this has happened in a lot of races around the country. I'm also sorry that Barbara Lee and Katie Porter didn't get a chance to go to November because I think they're very impressive people. But this is politics, and the politics that we have now is a classic two-party race in California for the U.S. Senate.
The other state with big news about the Senate campaigns was Arizona, where Kyrsten Sinema announced her retirement. When she was elected 6 years ago, that was a triumph of a massive effort by grassroots groups in Arizona. But in Washington, she turned out to be a kind of a semi-disaster. Her main achievements were blocking reform of the Senate's filibuster rule and single-handedly blocking the Democrats from raising taxes on wealthy investors. And she also voted against raising the minimum wage, keeping it at $7.25. You may remember she curtsied after casting that vote. She quit the Democratic Party, was going to run as an independent. There was very little support for that. And she was clearly going to come in third. So she dropped out. That leaves a clean race between one Republican, Carrie Lake, the nutty, if I may use that term, election denier, and Ruben Gallego. The latest poll in Arizona has Ruben Gallego ahead of Carrie Lake, 46-39. That's very good news for Democrats.
Yeah. Getting Kyrsten Sinema out of that race and out of the Senate is good news for Democrats. There's simply no question of that. Although, remember, she caucused with the Democrats, even with all of her opposition. So she and Joe Manchin were both useful for the purpose of organizing the Senate. And Democrats are going to worry about that going forward. Manchin's seat is likely to go Republican, very likely. And the California seat is now up for grabs, because even if you aren't very impressed with Carrie Lake, a lot of Arizona voters have been. And so that will be a competitive race. It will be an intense race. I think the Democrats have the upper hand there, but it's not a big upper hand. And so having Sinema out of there does help, without a doubt. They've now got what looks like a strong candidate going forward, the Democrats. And so that makes Arizona less, somewhat less of a challenge, especially if they open up, Democrats open up a reasonable poll lead. That would mean then that money from the national Democrats can move to some of these other states, like Montana with John Tester, Ohio with Sherrod Brown, potentially Texas, which, by the way, had its primary yesterday, and Colin Allred came through to run against Ted Cruz. So bottom line is that Democrats in this case, in the case of Arizona, although it wasn't a primary result, had a very good day yesterday as regards their Senate prospects.
One more interesting poll. There's a new for about the national picture. There's a new survey by the AP NORC Center for Public Affairs Research found that the majority of Americans believe neither Biden nor Trump has the mental acuity to serve as president for another 4 years. The majority believe neither one has the mental acuity. What do you make of that?
Well, it is not necessarily an encouraging number for America, because, you know, look, we're running a presidential race between two people that the American electorate doesn't seem to be very excited about. But I think we already knew that. In a weird way, it's somewhat good, I guess, for Biden, because, of course, the Republicans have been trying to suggest that somehow Biden is more inept than Trump. I've never necessarily believed that. But now it looks like the American people are coming to a conclusion that they're not very impressed with either of them. At the end of the day, that then pushes the campaign back toward issues, right? Back toward, you know, mobilizing your base around the issues you're running on to vote for one or the other of two candidates who are not necessarily beloved by the electorate. For the Democrats, that's probably a good thing because we'll see this week with Biden's State of the Union address. He still has a lot of room in which to kind of alleviate some of these concerns about his age and things like that. But B, if it's an issue-based fight in November, we saw from 2020, and frankly, we even saw from 2016, that on balance, the majority of people that go vote, or at least the clear plurality of people that go vote, tend to go for the Democrats. And so I guess, although, again, a disappointing number for America, and one that everybody should be conscious of, but one that may turn the 2024 presidential race, oddly enough, into more of a classic contest between, you know, left and right, Democrats and Republicans.
And last but not least, we're speaking on Wednesday, the day after Super Tuesday. You are traveling in Madison with Kamala Harris. What's on her schedule? Where will you be? What will she be doing?
She is basically emphasizing the president's infrastructure program. She's at a bus barn, and she is talking about the accomplishments of the infrastructure program. They're, literally, I think she's going to be speaking in front of, churned up gravel with guys in orange jackets, digging on things. And so it's very much on message. But in a deeper sense, yeah, I'm always following the vice president. I've interviewed her for The Nation several times, and in this case, I'm very interested in what she may say about Gaza. Remember, she talked about Gaza in Selma on Sunday, and it was interesting because she seemed to have a more enthusiastic endorsement of ceasefire than we've heard from a lot of other folks in the administration. Although, again, insufficient because it tends to be a temporary ceasefire. And B, I'm going to be very interested because as she's been campaigning around the country, she's put a real emphasis on abortion rights, reproductive freedom, which I think it's pretty clear the Democrats think is an issue that's going to be very critical for them in November. So, you know, although there, you know, we still have quite a few primaries ahead of us, I think Super Tuesday gave us a pretty good perspective on where this race is headed. And so in many senses, what I'm doing with the vice president today is covering the November race, or at least getting ready to cover the November race.
John Nichols, read him at thenation.com. Thank you, John. Now you need to get back to Kamala.
I do need to get back to the political trail. It's great to be with you, John. Take care. Be strong.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Now is the time to add the right to vote to the Constitution. That's what Rick Hassan says. He's professor of law and political science at UCLA and director of UCLA's Safeguarding Democracy Project. He writes for the New York Times op-ed page, also for Slate and Politico. He's written several books about elections and democracy. The new one is A Real Right to Vote, How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. Rick Hassan, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Well, we've had huge political and legal battles over voting, especially in the last decade, and that's partly because Republicans have lost the popular vote for president in 7 out of the last 8 elections. A lot of people don't realize this. In the last 4 presidential elections, Democrats have averaged 51%, Republicans 46%. It's the worst performance for the Republicans over 4 elections since FDR's presidency. The Democrats believe that the more people vote, the more likely that their candidates will be elected. So Democrats want to make it easier to vote. They want automatic voter registration. They want universal voting by mail. The Republicans have decided the best way for their candidates to win is to restrict voting rights, to make it harder to register, harder to cast the ballot, to create obstacles to voting by groups they consider Democratic, voter suppression. So Republicans agree with Democrats that higher turnout, more people voting, helps Democrats. It's one of the few things the two parties agree on. Do you agree?
I don't. When we hold elections, we for president, we use the Electoral College. And if we were actually using the popular vote, campaigns would look very different. Donald Trump would be spending a lot of time in Florida and Texas getting his numbers up. Biden would be in California more than using it as an ATM. He would actually be coming to get votes. So, you know, there's only so much we can learn. But there's a study that I cite in my book, A Real Right to Vote, by Professors Petrosik and Shaw, that shows that bigger turnout does not necessarily help Democrats. And in fact, I believe that if Donald Trump did not complain about mail-in voting in the middle of a pandemic, the safest way to vote in the middle of a pandemic, that he well could have won the 2020 election. He shot himself in the foot. And I'd say more generally, one of the things we see about the transformation of the Republican Party is that it is appealing more to working class, poorer, less educated voters. I mean, didn't Trump make the claim he loves the less educated, right? Yes. Those are people who are most likely to be disenfranchised by draconian election laws. And so if this trend continues, even if Republicans believe that they should write their election laws to help their party, that might mean a loosening of these rules rather than a further restriction of them. I don't think that it's necessarily in the long-term Republican interest to make voting harder.
I've always believed the consensus view. So I looked up Darren Shaw and John Petrosik's book. They do show that turnout rates do not predict election results in presidential elections. There's just some very simple examples. The biggest Democratic victory, 1964, LBJ over Goldwater, did not have the highest Democratic turnout. The highest Democratic turnout was in 2020, Biden versus Trump. But obviously, as you suggest, there's a lot of other reasons why these candidates won. Goldwater was a terrible candidate. 2020 had a high turnout because Trump was running for re-election and people were very passionate about that. I know you're not in the business of giving advice to Democrats, but if you were, would you advise them to stop putting so much money and energy into mobilizing low propensity voters and non-voters?
No, I think that the whole system is messed up. If you look at other countries and how they run their elections, first of all, they're not having fights every 4 years about what the rules are. But also, most other countries have a rational system where all eligible voters are automatically registered to vote, and they're identified. And that's part of what I proposed in A Real Right to Vote. If we actually had a rational system for how we ran our elections, not only would we get rid of a lot of the fights over elections, which I think would have a lot of social benefits to get rid of the lawyering up of our elections, but it also would allow more time to be put not into voter registration, where Democrats and others put a tremendous amount of time and effort, but instead into convincing voters, here's why you should turn out. And that's actually a better form of democracy, right? Rather than spending your efforts to making sure that people can, who are already eligible to vote, can jump through the hoops that each state sets up on its own, you're instead having an argument about ideas. Is Joe Biden or Donald Trump worthy of your vote or someone else?
Let's talk about the proposed constitutional amendment for a right to vote. Why isn't the right to vote in the Constitution? I'm an American historian, and so I know that's because the founding fathers really didn't believe in democracy. They believed in a very limited right to vote, and the words right to vote were not added to the Constitution until after the Civil War in the 15th Amendment, ratified in 1870. But that did not establish a universal right to vote. Explain where we stand with the right to vote in the Constitution right now.
It's the combination of two things, the age of our Constitution and the difficulty of amendment, that explains why we don't have a right to vote compared to, again, most other democracies have a right to vote in their newer constitutions. You're right that the founders were skeptical of voting. There was no right to vote for president in the Constitution. And in fact, in the year 2000, in the controversial Bush versus Gore case, the Supreme Court reminded us that we have no right to vote for president, that state legislatures could take it back at any time for future elections. So that's some news that Americans probably did not expect to hear. There have been proposals for universal voting in the United States that date back to the time of the 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment is the first amendment that actually says no discrimination in voting on the basis of a particular characteristic, in this case, race, parallel to the 19th Amendment, which is about gender, the 26th Amendment, which is about being 18 to 21 years old. These rights are framed in the negative, but back at the time of the 15th Amendment, there was a proposal to say, you know, at least all citizen adult, back in the time of the 15th Amendment, men could vote. And that was rejected because that was going to allow immigrants to vote. That was going to allow some poor people to vote who couldn't pass a literacy test. You know, there's all kinds of reasons to discriminate. So even when Black voters were supposedly being enfranchised by the 15th Amendment, that didn't really happen effectively in parts of the country until the 1965 Voting Rights Act. But even then, it's like, we're not going to let the Irish vote. You know, like, we're not going to let the Chinese vote. There was so much xenophobia back at that time, unlike today when we have no xenophobia, right? But it was after the 15th, at the time of the 15th Amendment, and then we saw this arise again as the civil rights movement started. So there were proposals in 1959 and 1960. Then we saw it again after the 2000 election when the election system essentially broke down. But there's not traction. And in the 1960s, I think the reason we lost traction is because so many voting related good things did happen. The 23rd Amendment gave voting rights for president to Washington, D.C. residents. The 24th Amendment abolished federal poll taxes. The 26th Amendment already mentioned 18 to 20 year olds. And you got the passage of both the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So maybe people thought we didn't need the amendment. And of course, at that same time in the late 1960s, that's when the Warren Court is just in its heyday and it's expanding voting rights through what I would consider a very capacious reading of the 14th Amendment, one that I don't think a majority of the current Supreme Court would actually agree with if they had to revisit those questions. That's one of the reasons why I think we need to enshrine the right to vote in the Constitution, because in the 235-year history of the Supreme Court, 8 years of good opinions is not enough, especially when it can be reversed.
So exactly what should a right to vote amendment to the Constitution say?
In the back of A Real Right to Vote, I have an appendix that has what I call the basic amendment, and then I've got some add-ons. So, you know, like, you know, you've got your, like when you're looking at a restaurant menu, you know, you got your base, and then you can like, you know, do you want to add avocado on that, right? So I start with the basics. And the reason I start with a more basic amendment is because I do believe that there is some room for some bipartisan compromise, not today, but maybe in 10 or 20 years. And so I want to lay it out there in a more basic way. The basic amendment would do six things. One is assuring that adult citizen resident non-felons have a right to vote for president. So state legislatures can't take that vote back. We'd be changing Article 2 of the Constitution. That votes should be equally weighted, that voting laws should not be overly burdensome. And when courts weigh disputes over voting, they should put a thumb on the scale favoring voters instead of what they do now, which is put a thumb on the scale favoring states when they raise issues that they don't prove, like, well, this is needed to prevent voter fraud or promote voter confidence, that the courts have to defer more to Congress when Congress expands voting rights. Congress has been the great source of the expansion of voting rights. And finally, I would enshrine part of the Voting Rights Act in the Constitution, because again, I do not trust the Supreme Court. So I'd rather constitutionalize it to make it harder for some of the more anti-voting justices to restrict voting rights or not let Congress expand voting rights.
Well, Republicans argue that voter fraud is a huge problem in America. Pollsters found that Trump has convinced about a third of Americans that Biden won only because of election fraud. Is there any validity to this? And how would a constitutional amendment change claims like that?
Well, there is voter fraud in the United States. It's just extremely rare. We did have an instance, for example, involving a Republican primary in North Carolina and for Congress in 2018. That led to a whole new election. There's currently the fraud case in Bridgeport, Connecticut, involving absentee ballots. So it happens. It tends to happen in smaller elections in places where there's not vibrant news media, but it's pretty rare. And it's the hardest thing to do is to try to steal a presidential election because it would involve so many people. Unless you could actually change the way that the state reports votes, it would be extremely difficult to do. So voter fraud is real, but very rare. But there are things we could do to make it even harder. For example, we could rationalize, as I mentioned, our voter registration system. We could say that everyone who's eligible, but only people who are eligible, are going to be registered, and we're going to give you a number, and that number is going to follow you your whole life. So if you move from New Jersey to Wyoming, your same number is going to work with you there. And so there's lots that we can do. And one of the arguments I make for, you started off with what's in it for conservatives, we could make rare voter fraud even rarer. We could also make it harder to steal elections. So I mentioned this idea that state legislatures wouldn't be able to take away the right of the people to vote for president. Well, you may remember that was a key part of Donald Trump's efforts to steal the 2020 election was by getting state legislatures.
That's what we call the fake elector scheme.
Right. And that, even though I think that you couldn't do that even under the rules as we have now, it would be nice to have a constitutional provision that underlines the point that the people have the right to vote and this can never be taken away by state legislatures. That wouldn't require getting rid of the Electoral College. You could still say within each state, the appointment of electors has to be done by popular vote, not by legislatures. And I should say, since I've mentioned the Electoral College, I've got four add-ons. One of them is get rid of the Electoral College. There have been a lot of books on that. I don't spend too much time on it, even though I would support it. I think that could well be a deal breaker for Republicans, which is why I put it in the avocado add-on section. I would also abolish the Senate, which, you know, we're here in California. We have the same voting power in the Senate as people who live in Rhode Island or in Wyoming, which are very small populations, and that's not in line with a one-person, one-vote ideal. I would also enfranchise former felons, because what we've seen recently in Florida with the Florida voters voting to re-enfranchise felons, and then the state legislature coming in and essentially finding a way to nullify that, makes me think we can't trust states on this issue. And then finally, I would deal with voting rights for people who live in U.S. territories, people who live in Puerto Rico, people who live in Washington, D.C., who still don't get congressional representation, Guam, Virgin Islands, American Samoa. There are people that are part of the United States. They're adults. They're, except for in American Samoa, they're considered citizens, but yet they do not have the right to vote for president. There's lots of ways to deal with that. I think the first question when it comes to people in U.S. territories is about self-determination. They actually want to be fully part of the United States and be part of the rights and responsibilities of the United States. If they do, they should have the same right to vote as the rest of us.
One of your claims is that a constitutional right to vote would reduce the litigation around voting. Trump filed 62 lawsuits challenging the vote count in 2020. Couldn't he do that anyway, even if there was a constitutional right?
Nobody can stop you from filing lawsuits. All you have to do is find a lawyer, and even that is optional, and pay a filing fee. The question is, would it stop serious lawsuits? Most of those lawsuits filed by Trump were not serious. You know, like if we had this constitutional right to vote amendment and Trump were trying to steal the election, he might have still filed those suits, but it would just be much harder. If this amendment passes, so many of the things that are the subject of litigation today would no longer be litigable, if that's the right word. One of the examples I give in the book involves voting rights in North Dakota. So North Dakota, you may remember, had a Democratic senator, Heidi Heitkamp. She was elected in an increasingly red state, thanks in part to the support of Native American voters. And I think, unsurprisingly, Republicans in the state legislature didn't want Heitkamp to be reelected. So they passed a rule that said that if you want to vote, you've got to produce a residential street address. You know, you live on, 123 University Drive, right? So that's easy for most people to do, but it turns out to be very difficult to do if you're very poor Native American living on a reservation. And so this law was aimed at that. It took numerous lawsuits and 6.5 years between the time that this law was passed and the time that the case is finally settled. This is not how we should be running our democracy. It should not take years and thousands of lawyer hours, which cost money, even if they're by nonprofits. Somebody has to pay those people. It should not be this way when it comes to voting rights. Much of this litigation would be gone. And if everybody is affirmatively registered by the government and identified, much of the basis on which things could be litigated would be done with.
The hardest argument that you have to make is that there are reasons why Republicans should support an amendment. To understand this, I think it helps to look at how previous amendments to the Constitution that expanded the right to vote were passed. Votes for women, 1920, votes for 18-year-olds, 1971. I think your best argument is that it will take a while, but the campaigns themselves will accomplish a lot. For example, women's suffrage. That's one of the most interesting parts of your book, I thought.
I thought so, too. I mean, I didn't know a lot of this history, and so I was fascinated by it. I'm glad that me describing it at least has one reader who thought so, too. So in 1874, the Supreme Court decided Minor versus Heppersett. This is a case where a woman, she was a citizen, adult, resident of Missouri. She wanted to vote for president. She couldn't because the state constitution said only men can vote. She went to the Supreme Court and said, we've just ratified the 14th Amendment. It protects the privileges or immunities of citizenship, and voting is such a privilege. And the Supreme Court said, yes, you're a citizen, which is better than they did for Black Americans. But they said to her, yes, you're a citizen, but you do not get the right to vote. That's a question of state law. And between there was a women's suffrage movement before this case, but afterwards it shifted the battle to the states. And over the next four decades, there was organization in the states, women and their allies, organized, and they fought for rights to vote. So by the time we get to 1920 and the passage and ratification of the 19th Amendment, barring discrimination and voting on the basis of sex, 30 states had changed their state constitutions. So there was a popular movement around voting rights that led to changes first on the smaller level and then on the national level. That's the model that I'm looking at. So we can't think of the time horizon. Like we're always lurching from crisis to crisis in the country in our elections. We can't think of the timeline as only the next 6 months or 2 years. Yes, we have to worry about things in the next 6 months or 2 years, but we also have to think more longer term so that we're not, you know, in a constant state of anxiety and uncertainty about our elections.
And part of that longer term is realizing that the Republicans may not always be the party of Trump and election denial and voter suppression. After Mitt Romney lost to Obama in 2012, the Republicans did a lot of soul searching about why that happened. They had a commission, they called it an autopsy, and they concluded that the party needed to broaden its appeal to reach out to young people, people of color, and women. And they actually had a candidate who embodied this new kind of Republican, Marco Rubio. Remember him, young person of color. Of course, Trump crushed him in the primaries that year, and the party took the opposite course. But you suggest the Trump vision of what the Republican Party should be may not last forever.
Well, you remember the Whigs? I mean, you do because you're a historian, but most people don't. You go back to the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. It was supported by many Republicans. It was opposed by many Democrats. The parties looked different in 1965. Why should we think that in 2065, the parties are going to look like they do in 2024? So we don't know. There may be a moment. My book is ready to pull off the shelf when that moment comes. Okay. But like we have to, you know, we have a failure of imagination in this country. We also have lost muscle memory when it comes to amending the Constitution. I mentioned the 26th Amendment was in 1971, before most Americans were born. I know that probably makes you feel old, like it makes me feel old, but most Americans were not born in 1971. So people have no memories of the Constitution being amended. So, you know, how can we get back to that? And it's hard in a moment of polarization to see it, but we may get there. And we've got to get through the next decade first.
And also, it is very hard to amend the Constitution, but in 1971, it happened very quickly, actually.
Well, the 26th Amendment was kind of funny. What happened was
this is 18-year-old voting. 18-year-old voting we're talking about.
Right, so Vietnam War, Congress had passed a statute enfranchising 18 to 21-year-olds, went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court issued this split decision where they said, yeah, you can apply this to federal elections, but not to state elections. And then everyone's scrambling, like, how are we going to run an election where we only let 18 to 21-year-olds vote some races, but not others? And so it was the fastest amendment ratified in U.S. history. Some amended the same day that Congress had passed the amendment because everybody agreed with it. You know, in the middle of the war, who's going to be against young soldiers, which is, you know, how this thing was sold. And so it happened. Hard to imagine it happening today, given that youth are much more likely to be liberal. Same, it's hard to imagine the 23rd Amendment, which was the one that gave Washington, D.C. 3 electoral college votes. Can you imagine if that were up today, given how Democratic D.C. is? That would be a non-starter, right? I mean, just like if you know, this talk about making D.C. a state, which I favor, assuming DC residents would want it. Why not, you know, do that? Well, you know, you're going to get a lot of Republican opposition. In fact, to make DC or Puerto Rico a state, you don't need a constitutional amendment to do that. Congress could do it. And they could have done it back when Democrats controlled both houses. I think they should have done it. If they would have added DC and Puerto Rico, would have had 4 more senators, would have made things a little less unequal in the Senate.
In the end here, We've talked about the distant past, the possible futures. I want to talk about the next couple of months. What is your biggest worry about the upcoming election in November? 4 years ago, we had foreign interference, massive misinformation, attempts at election subversion, the fake elector scheme. Are you worried we could get a rerun of all of that?
Sure, we could get a rerun. I mean, one benefit we have is we're not running an election in the middle of a pandemic. And the pandemic caused a lot of changes in voting rules, caused a lot of litigation over those changes. So we won't have that. And people are on guard now. Like I wrote back in 2009 when Obama took over from Bush, how we take peaceful transitions of power for granted in this country. We no longer take them for granted. I think people are very concerned. In fact, Republicans are more concerned about stolen elections than Democrats, if you look at polling, because they believe the last election was stolen. So people are on guard. I don't think things are going to look exactly like they did in 2020. We're not going to see a storming of the Capitol. There's going to be a very fortified, you know, fence around the Capitol. We're probably not going to see the fake elector scheme, in part because Congress changed the rules and the Supreme Court issued an important case called Moore versus Harper that kind of shuts a lot of that down. But we have new concerns. For example, what about the insider threat of elections? What if you have people running elections who believe or say they believe the false claim the last election was stolen? Might they want to manipulate things to even the score? What about the threats of election-related violence? We saw a little bit of that in 2022, less than I expected, which was a happy thing. But I think we have to be vigilant. And under the auspices of the Safeguarding Democracy Project, a committee of us issued a report called 24 for 24 with recommendations for things that could be done in law, media, politics, and tech to make the election safer. Some of those things can be implemented right now. And I think we can't be complacent. I don't think people are complacent. People are rightly concerned, but it's not a reason for panic. Our election in 2020 was actually run very well, considering that it was done in the middle of a pandemic. And so I have more confidence the election will be run fairly than that people will believe the election was run fairly. And that crisis of confidence is a very important question. A democracy depends on losers accepting the results of fair elections. But that's not a problem with how the election is run. It's a problem with the rhetoric around how the election is run.
Rick Hassan, his new book is A Real Right to Vote: How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. Rick, this was great. Thanks for talking with us today.
That was a real pleasure.
That's it for Living in the USA for today. Our producer and social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Our audio editor is Alan Minsky. Thanks as always to Rai Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at applepodcast.com, Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.